Now for the opening panel, which is going to be moderated by Ken Rosenthal, and we're really glad to have Ken back again. Ken was here the first year with us. Quick introduction for Ken. Ken is a baseball insider for MLB Network. He regularly appears on MLB Tonight and Hot Stove. Sports writer for more than 20 years. Ken's also FoxSports.com's senior baseball writer and a weekly contributor to the Fox Saturday Baseball Game of the Week. And now I will turn it over to Ken Rosenthal.
Hi, thanks, Mark. Happy to be here, and I will now introduce our panel, which is a really good one. Let's start all the way down to my right. He is the Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Seattle Mariners, entering his sixth season. He spent a lot of money this winter, and we will talk to him about that. Jack Sorensic. Next to Jack, entering his 14th year with the Colorado Rockies, the Senior Vice President, Assistant GM, Bill Guyvette. And right next to me, entering his 21st year in the Giants Baseball Operations Department, Vice President and Assistant General Manager, Bobby Evans. All right, we're going to start with a basic question, and hopefully it will lead to a lot of other questions. It'll actually be kind of two-pronged. This is a panel that is going to discuss decision-making in the front office. So let's start with the basic decisions that are made, at least the ones that we like to discuss, trades and free agents. Jack, let's start with you. The process that you guys take when entering into trade discussions.
First, let me just say this. You may or may not know this, but Bobby Evans is a proud new papa. So he just had a son named Jackson a few days ago. So congratulations. His third child. I thanked Bobby before we came in here for naming him Jackson. It was as close as he could get to Jack. So anyhow. You know, I think you have to take everything into consideration when you're making a trade. Number one, you listen to what your people say in the field. Number two, you listen to everything that's gone on in your office with analytics. I think you look at the finances involved. That's a huge component on what you can do. How can you fit a player into what you're trying to do? And then you decide as you go through all of the issues presented above on how that player fits with your ball club. In our particular situation, I've never made a move where I don't have a discussion with our manager as well. I've always found it to get them on board, because at the beginning when you start talking about a possible trade, to catch them, you know, unprepared, I think is not good. I think when you get them on board, you get their thinking, and we'll explain to them the reason why we do things, because as these guys know, oftentimes you have a manager will come to you and say, we need to go get this guy, we need to get this player. They see that player in a short period of time against them, but I think we try to create a picture where how a particular player helps our organization. That's the beginning process of it. There's a lot more that goes into it, but I think those are initial stages to lay the groundwork to begin a deal.
Now, Bill, some trades come together, it seems, within a day or two. And then other trades, it's a month, 2 months, 3 months before it's completed. How is it that some can happen so quickly and some drag out?
Well, I think first off, it's just based off need. I mean, if you need something, they need something. Those are the ones that tend to work out very quickly. What I'm getting disturbed by, we had one trade where we were in talks and discussions. The only problem was it was all by text. So I said, you know, I had to pick up the phone and call. I said, you know, at this point, we cannot have the first trade completed all by text. That's inappropriate. But we did actually get that done just with one phone call. But that's really the thing. I mean, when there's that need and they match up, I think everybody in today's game is very quick to act. Whereas in past years, I think you would see, certainly when I started in this business, and when you're talking to guys, it seemed like, well, we got to talk to our people, we got to do this and that. Whether it was even back to the last expansion draft, it was really a time-consuming process. Whereas now, everybody's ready to go. They know who they want from you, and they've done all the research and all the studying, and they put things together very quickly.
Bobby, in the case of the Giants, or any team for that matter, how much have things changed, as Bill alluded to, in the past 5 to 10 years, just in the manner of trade talks, the use of email and text, and all of that?
Well, I think it allows us to start trade discussions much earlier in the fact that, you know, it's so easy to just flip a quick message to your counterpart, to open up the dialogue, to propose the what if. You know, you start looking at your options even in spring training because there's tremendous opportunity for scouting and evaluating. Ultimately, when you get into trade talks, you're looking at what your needs are and what options are available and the accessibility of you know, all the club executives is so much easier. You don't have to worry about whether they're in the middle of a game or not. You're not going to interrupt them because you can send them a text, and whether they respond or not is, you know, all timing for them. But the communication lines being so open does make it a lot easier, I think, for all clubs to make those deals when the time comes.
Now, Jack, is something lost from the old days when, for instance, at the winter meetings, a club would get together, brainstorm, and now that doesn't really happen? The verbal communication is not there.
It really depends on who you're dealing with. I think that, you know, we were talking about this yesterday. It's funny that some general managers do a lot of stuff strictly through texting. I think we all text. It's an easier way to get someone's attention. Even during the middle of a ball game, you get a text. Somebody has an idea. But there are other guys, like Bill says, that want to sit face-to-face. Sometimes you get into a room, and sometimes you have to do a little brainstorming. You know, you may have an idea. You may have a thought. You may have a particular player that you want to talk about. But if you can have the face-to-face or the phone conversation, it may expand to something else that comes back to, well, we can't exactly do that, but there's another part of our club that maybe we can get to a point where we can agree on a trade or a deal. So I think it's different. I remember years ago, you know, and I say many years ago, you'd sit in a room and go to winter meetings, and you'd have 12 people in a room. I find that a little bit uncomfortable sometimes. I find guys nowadays would like to have a smaller group. When you leave the room, you get a text, you get an email, and you follow up from there.
All right, free agency, entirely different animal. Bobby, I'll start with you. Off-season begins. How do the Giants go about determining which free agents to pursue? And then from there, how does it go?
Well, it starts right now. We start looking at, you know, who's going to be free at the end of the year. You start evaluating what fits might be available for your club. And you're doing that through a lot of different pieces of information. I mean, it's clear that the statistics for 2014 will help determine a lot of the performance of these players, of course, but you've got history, you've got scouting reports, you've got a lot of information that we can start evaluating what our options may be. When the bell rings and the free agent period actually opens, you know, we're trying to be particular about who we contact. We don't want to contact every free agent just to get our name in the hat. We want to be sure that we're contacting free agents that we have legitimate interest in pursuing. And we target those guys. And I think early on, agents know what our interest level is, at least for the groundbreaking of conversation. And, you know, we're gonna make sure all along that there's a communication level that the agents are comfortable with, that there's a clear understanding of kind of what our threshold is, where they are, maybe even in the pecking order of our other options. There's never an advantage to misleading a free agent. You have to deal with the agents, you know, throughout your year, whether it's through the amateur draft or through your own players. So ultimately, you don't want to be misleading when you're dealing with the agents and their free agents, and you don't want to cost them a deal somewhere else by you're trying to hold on to a conversation while you've got something else stirring. So I think it's all about being transparent, but yet making sure that at the end of the day, you get the top priorities are addressed that will fill the needs of your club.
Bill, how do you see that with Colorado? Obviously, it's a different situation with each of you guys, the ballparks that you play in, and how that affects things. But the way the Rockies approach free agency, are you targeting certain kinds of players?
Well, we feel like we have to. I mean, Bobby spoke about, you know, all the ways you look at it prior to some type of acquisition. But as far as specific players, we certainly look at Coors Field and where we play as unique. And I think over the years, we've probably learned to put that a little bit more in perspective and to be a little bit more direct in terms of how we see a particular position and what we'd like to acquire. You know, we have different aspects of that ballpark and the altitude as well that play into where we're at and how we look at players and pitchers alike. And it becomes very easy, I think, when you do that, not to acquire them, obviously, but to figure out exactly what type of player you'd like or what type of pitcher you'd like. And, you know, the difficulty is in the acquisition, obviously, in terms of whether it's finances or another team just won't give them up. But at the same point, I think we've gotten to a point now where we're pretty direct in terms of what we like.
Jack, this offseason, obviously, the Mariners made the biggest splash of all. Robinson Cano, 10 years, $240 million. The process of that is something that none of us really know about. How did that come about?
You know, it started, and our process in terms of trying to make your club better is as soon as the season's concluded, we draw up what we think, and I'll bring in all of our office guys. We call them our baseball op guys that do a lot of the analytics. I'll ask all of them, give me your opinion. They'll put down their opinions on paper. We'll do the same with the heads of the department and the scouts out in the field. What do you think we need to do to make our club better? So we'll identify certain areas, and particularly in this year, you know, one of the things we thought we needed was an impact offensive player. There were some players out there that we liked, that we thought we'd have a shot for, but we really thought that was a need based on where our club was at, young players that were on their way to producing. Some have not yet. So when we first met at the general managers meetings in Orlando, I got a really good feel, like all these guys. You meet with a lot of different agents. And as we walked out of the room meeting with Robinson Cano's group, you know, it just seemed that, like, okay, you never know what will happen. But it was positive. And I think it carried on. The next week we followed up. The next couple of days we continued to follow up. I think timing is everything. And if you look back on what happened to the Yankees this year, where they wanted to stay under the threshold of the payroll, probably affected their initial offer. Then this whole process started with the agents coming to Seattle. We sat with them, got a really good feel. The very next day, we made an offer to Robinson Cano. We put the offer on a table, and we got their attention. And I think they were like, whoa, you know, instantly. Within 24 hours, they had a legitimate offer from us. We had a second meeting that was very positive as well. And then the third meeting, we brought Jay-Z. They brought it. You know, the whole Roc Nation group came up. Jay-Z came. Robinson Cano came. There were probably eight of them that rolled into Seattle. You may know this, you may not know this, but a little inside. It was Jay-Z's birthday the day before. We had a birthday cake for him. So we sang happy birthday.
Nice touch.
You know, so nice. Right. And this is well documented. You know, after the birthday cake, I said, hey, congratulations. But I was the original Jay-Z. He liked that, you know. So, and we can try to make it really light. And we really did a really good presentation for them. They were very engaged. And it was really interesting how the whole process became apart so quickly. So we were all in a room. There were probably 10 or 12 of us in a room. We had Robinson had great questions. He's a very astute baseball guy. Direct, this is what I want to know. This is what I see. He knew our club inside out. And we broke up. We met for about 3 hours. They toured the ballpark, toured the clubhouse. We broke. There's other parts to the story that I won't get into. But we broke about 3 hours into it, and we're going to dinner. And they went back to their hotel room, and I took the whole group, about eight of us, sitting in the office, went to dinner, getting out of my car in front of the Capitol Grill, and the phone rings, and it happens to be Brody Van Wagner, about an hour after we broke up. And he said, if you can get the 10 years of 240, we got a deal. We weren't there. And I said, well, let me make a couple phone calls. So I had called Howard Lincoln, who was in Hawaii, Chuck Armstrong, who was still in the office, and Chris Larson, one of our owners, and then Bart Waldman, was the lawyer, was with me. And over about a 45-minute conversation we had, we called them back and we said, 240, 10, we got a deal. We got a deal. And that was it. So the rest is history.
Jack, as you're going through that process, what's your heartbeat level?
Hey, I've had it broken before, so, you know, half of a heartbeat in some cases. No, you know, we've been on this road before. And I think it was really funny about this one because, as weird as it might sound to all of you out there, and I know during the week leading up to that, you know, we were stalking horse. The Mariners will never get Robinson Cano. The Mariners are being used. You know, we heard all of that, but I don't know. Just there was a feeling there that this might really happen. He liked playing in Safeco. He really loved the city. You know, he thought this was a he recognized all the young players. He visioned himself, him and Felix, and about nine other guys that he recommended that we should sign. You know, but if you guys have read that, anyhow, it was normal. It was exciting. I mean, now you're sitting there with Jay-Z and that whole group. That was interesting. But at the end, you know, it's a process that we've all gone through. The dollars here were enormous. The years were enormous. But it was a fun process, quite honestly. Didn't know where it would ever end. You know, I mean, where we would end up with dollars. Wasn't sure what kind of permission I would get from ownership to spend. But it was a unique process. It was fun. And it was, it wasn't stressful. It was like all of us have been through, fingers crossed. But, you know, and it worked out.
Bobby, the Giants, of course, are in a unique position. They've won four World Series. And that influences decision-making, too. And obviously, you want to reward the guys that got you there. Right. How tricky is it knowing when to do that versus when to let a player go, even as he has contributed in such a major way to your team?
Well, we've, after winning in 2012, we felt a lot like the team that won it was not the team that started the year for us. And in many ways, you know, bringing them back in 2013 was bringing back the team that had been together for the last 2 months of the season, namely Hunter Pence and Marco Scudero. But the truth is that both times we haven't come back very strong after bringing back the team that got us the ring. But as we evaluate the makeup of our club and as we evaluate the strengths of our club, we're prepared every year to take a fresh approach. But ultimately, you know, there's limited options. There's invariably expected performance that you'll have with your relative free agents and relative to your own. And we also know what's in the pipeline for us. And I think that we worked hard after the 2010 World Series in discussions with Juan Uribe, bringing him back. He was a big part of our club. We also knew that Pablo had a setback in 2010, and therefore we wanted to prepare ourselves and have Juan come back in really a super utility role. Well, the dollars were not super utility dollars, and ultimately he went to L.A., and Pablo emerged back in better form and had a good 2011, and it ended up working out for us by 2012 to acquire Marco Scudero to fill our second base need and Hunter Pence in the outfield. But for us, every year is a clean slate in a sense, whether there's guys under contract, but there's also guys that are coming up that we're going to have to make decisions about. And I think the toughest one this offseason could have been Tim Lincecum for us, just because of all that he's accomplished as a Giant, two World Series, two Cy Young, amazing job in the 2012 postseason in relief. What is the future for Tim Lincecum? And those kind of decisions can't be all based on emotion. Otherwise, you're going to make yourself miserable as you watch your club throughout the season. I think that some of the things that we looked at in knowing your own player best, this is a player that had never shown the discipline in the off season to prepare himself, you know, the way that most pitchers today prepare themselves. So we felt like we could get through to him. And we also had the benefit of the fact that he was willing to do a shorter-term deal. And we also had the benefit of the fact that, you know, we kind of knew there was a floor. There was no way we were going to get him signed below the qualifying offer of $14+ million. So we had some ranges, and ultimately we've brought him back with the hope that he can fit in as a number three or number four starter with Tim Hudson, who we think will be a great mentor to him. And so decisions are very complex sometimes, but you try to take everything into account, the person, the performance, the potential, the age, the dollar value, how it stacks up against your alternatives. And ultimately, we want to put a team out there that we think has the best chance to win, regardless of whether it's the same team from the year before.
Now, to follow up on that, the Lincecum deal was early. It was before free agency even began. The market is different every year. It's difficult to predict at all times. How do you determine a value? Because as we saw, the pitching market did not erupt, except in very rare cases, Tanaka being one. It was probably disappointing to the pitchers involved. So how did you look at Lincecum and say, okay, this is the number?
Well, I think for us, the value, we had really the opportunity to get a two-year deal done, which we felt that on the market, you just don't know where other clubs may be willing to go, whether it be 3, 4, or 5 years, you don't know. But the fact that we had an opportunity to get a two-year deal done with an overpay without him even going into the market, for us, there was value in that. The potential, the metrics of what he is capable of accomplishing, even with a depleted or diminished velocity, we saw, at a qualifying offer, you were looking at a two-year deal being at 28. So obviously they started much higher, but we both quickly came to the two-year number. So then it really became a matter of bringing them down and bringing ourselves up, knowing that we were going to be at least at 28. And we knew there would be an overpay potential here just because you're keeping them from even going into the market. And that was where we compromised.
Bill, it always fascinates me in free agency, and I'll ask Jack this as well, following up, how the matrix kind of evolves and how things change and how you have to react. And I'm wondering if you can just take me through your offseason and how you had to adjust at certain times to get what you wanted to accomplish.
Well, we're definitely in a much different situation than the Giants. And this ring here is a constant reminder of that, of this guy's. He has to flash it over here every once in a while. But, we're coming off of a couple last place finishes. Still believing in a core group of players. And how we look at that and try to position ourselves in terms of making sure that we have the type of pitching that we need to be competitive in a very offensive ballpark, I think really, is where are we at? That whole process of, where are you right now and how do you see that moving forward, I think is the biggest determinant of what you're going to do and what plan you take. And that's basically where we were, is how do we supplement that, certainly with veteran players and knowing that every time we had an injury, which, 6 month season is going to throw at you. You're going to have a lot of injury and a lot of setback, and what do you do when that happens? What is plan B? Our plan B was typically youth, and that would put us in, now we've got, young guys and anybody that's been around sports, and even at the college level, if there's senior leadership or upperclassmen leadership on that team, you got a very good chance to win. Much like our situation, we continually would put out youth as our backup, and that took us down in terms of experience and being able to compete at that level and actually win. We're competitive, but we really couldn't win. Now it's the point where we went in the offseason saying, okay, we need to add experienced, not just leadership, but experienced players that not only could compete, but could help you win at this level. And that that was the biggest thing for us. So as we go through that, that was probably, I think you go in with that plan, whatever it is. Jack wanted to get an impact player, went out and bought a cake, so to make sure that he got an impact player. For us, it was really looking at experience and where the 240 really didn't matter. It was
no,
the cake
not
that
at all.
Did it.
That's
okay.
Right.
So this guy must really like cake. So for us, that's your guide. And then coupled with what players really fit in your venue and where you play or your division and what you need, really just sets the tone for who's out there and who fits that criteria.
Now, to follow up on that, Brett Anderson, guy who's throwing really well in camp so far, and a guy who, I will say this, you guys don't have to, had some physical questions and, in fact, had flunked Toronto's physical to quash a trade that they had set up. What did you guys see, and how do you look at the medicals in determining whether this is going to be a move that we make?
Well, the medicals in Brett's case, certainly in Tommy John a couple years ago, he had come back from that. was Oakland's opening day starter last year, hurt his foot. I know there were some teams that had interest in him, and some had questions about the foot. From what we saw and what our medical people saw, everything would be fine with the foot. He was back, and it was not of a concern for the medical guys. Still for us, you know, a little bit. You want to see all our guys being healthy. But at the same time, we knew going in, we need to improve our starting rotation. We wanted an impact starter. So within that, you know, a strike thrower that gets ground balls but has an ability to be an impactful starter. So we roll into San Francisco. We have somebody to match up with Bumgardner or whoever else. You know, the top guys in our division, we had a chance to do that. And also to help stabilize our bullpen where we can get deeper in the game. He's a very efficient guy and can throw strikes and get ground balls, which is extremely important to us. All of that combined with to go out and get impact starter out on the free agent market, you're going to spend a lot of money. The acquisition cost for us was expensive in Drew Pomerantz, and certainly in years of control and only having two basically on Brett. But at the same time, it was worth the risk for us to go out and get this guy, even with the perceived medical issues and even with the just 2 years of control, because we really felt like we needed that impact at the front. We've got a group of guys in position players that we feel like, and pitchers with this group, it'll be interesting what they can achieve.
Okay, Jack, Jay-Z eats the cake. Cano takes the 240. At that point, your whole offseason changes. What happened in the days that followed in determining how you would press forward?
You know, as I said earlier, when the season ended, we identified what we thought our needs were. One was an impact player. We thought we needed a utility infielder. And we actually signed, at that time, we were going to have Nick Franklin and Brad Miller, you know, as our middle infield. So we signed Willie Bloomquist early on, thought he would fit the bill, you know, play both positions, play the outfield, and be a mentor to the young kids. But then we also said we need a right-handed bat, and we needed bullpen help. So as it unfolded, you know, we ended up going forward with Corey Hart, you know, as an answer to your right-handed bat scenario, hoping he's healthy. He's coming off knee surgery. And we realized there was risk there, but there's also a cost factor tied to him. So we thought that would help. And then late, we ended up, we also felt we needed a starting pitcher. We haven't gotten to that point yet, you know, at this moment, and, you know, ours are still open. We'll see what happens. But also then in the bullpen, you know, our last year, our bullpen, we have good arms in our bullpen. We didn't perform very well. A lot of reasons for it. Our starting pitching last year disappointed us, but overuse of the bullpen, inexperience, et cetera. So we had an opportunity to sign Fernando Rodney, and we thought that that helps the rest of your bullpen. So if Rodney performs close to the levels that he's performed at the last couple of years, now you take your Danny Farquhars, your Tom Wilhelmsons, your Furbush, your Medina, pushes everybody down a little. So from that standpoint, I think you looked at the ball club after it was all said and done, and you said you ended up adding an impact bat. You ended up getting a right-handed hitter, impact player, actually, bringing in a right-handed hitter, a bullpen piece, a utility infielder. We did re-sign Franklin Gutierrez to a small deal. Unfortunately, Franklin did not get healthy in the offseason. He came in, he looked great. But as January unfolded, those same issues that he has had in the past resurfaced, and he decided that he was going to step aside. So he's on a restricted list for us. But that's how we addressed our needs.
Jack, once Cano's signed, and obviously it's a huge investment, and your ownership now has to guarantee that money, how did they react? Did they say, whoa, we have to take a step back? Or was there a plan in place to say, if he took this, let's do this, this, and this?
Well, again, I think we were in a position, as I said, where we've had all these young players, your Ackleys, your Smokes, your Seegers, your Saunders, Zanino, you know, go through the whole group of young kids we had. And as Billy touched on, you know, to bring in a veteran player in one of this player's ability, you know, ownership, I think, wanted to do something of this nature. We had talked to other free agents as well during the process. At the time of signing Cano, now his 10 years, obviously, is huge. But the dollar figure, $24 million a year, there were other players that were right at that number. we just felt that it was better off. You look at this kid's value, you know, his WAR number, what this guy brings to the table. You know, he's putting up corner numbers as a middle infielder. Should he sustain himself for a number of years? We had a 41-year-old guy hit 29 home runs this year for us last year. So, you know, we were thinking that Cano's going to be a long-term deal for us. Will he be as valuable in year 7, 8, 9? Of course not. You know, we understood that. We needed him at this time for this young group of kids. Ownership bought in. You know, they thought this was the right thing to do. Since I've been there, it's always been at the right time, at the right point. We will invest. We also have some things coming up in the very near future, you know, with the potential of the TV money, et cetera, Major League Baseball dollars that weighed into this process. And I think when you look at his WAR value now and you figure if salaries continue to increase, you know, there's that scale where he's still going to have value to us for years to come.
Bill, the Rockies structure, front office structure, it's a little different than some other teams. And a couple of years ago...
A little different?
Okay. I'll let you explain. You and Dan moved into different roles, Dan O'Dowd. And I believe you may be the only decision maker at your level actually with an office in the clubhouse. How has that worked out, and how does the decision making with the Rockies maybe differ than it did before?
Well, I don't know that I'm actually in the clubhouse. At the same point, I lead the league in offices, I'll assure you that. I got one upstairs, I got them downstairs, I got them all over the place. I'll say this, I think as an organization, just in its entirety, I think we are much more connected between the front office ownership and our major league manager and field staff. And I think that was the whole idea of putting me in a role like this. I think both these guys will tell you that... you know, the assumption is that a general manager is just out there doing whatever he wants to do and what have you. But at the same point, as Jack alluded to, I mean, ownership is involved with every club. All of your scouting personnel and people that go out and try to help you make decisions, everybody's involved in what goes on. And then very rarely is a general manager, I don't know if there is one that's put in a spot where he can just make trades and do whatever he wants without answering to anybody or getting approval on something and having other people in the decision-making process. I can tell you over the course of my career, I've certainly seen that there's a lot more people involved in the decisions. I think that it's a little bit archaic to think that that you have a general manager just doing whatever he wants to do. In our situation, I think it's been helpful in a lot of ways that the issues and feelings of our field staff and our players is duly noted, and at the same point, from a front office ownership direction and how we want to do things, I think all that's represented in this type of setup, and I think it's unique. But I really do, you know, at the beginning it was kind of, even I was a little, okay, you know, here's what we're doing here, but at the same point, I think there's been a lot of people that have I don't want to say sacrifice, but I think put themselves in a position of saying what's best for the club is what we're going to do. What's best for our organization is what we're going to do. And I think we're all involved in that. And to try to put this thing together to make the best sense of whatever's in front of us and make the right decision.
Isn't part of that the fact that you are, with your office downstairs, closer to the major league staff, and the contact is easier? Is that part of the idea behind that?
No question about it. I'm with them every day. You know, I'm probably, you know, last year I was on every trip, and this year I don't know that I'll actually do that because my wife's going to kill me if I do that one. But, no, I'm with them every day. And, you know, we have regular meetings and regular contact, and that certainly is unique in Major League Baseball. But I am there all the time, but at the same time, I'm not there. And I think, you know, the one good thing about this is that this type of job came along when I could probably handle it the best. I've had enough years of experience of being around to know when I should be involved and know when I need to not be involved. And I think that's helpful. So I don't think that, I really don't think that someone with lesser experience and hasn't been around a lot to try to do this. I think you really need somebody who's been around and been seasoned. I've been trained by Felipe Alou and Davey Johnson And certainly Tommy Lasorda, I've been trained in too many ways. With those guys in the background of the perspective of the major league manager, I think it's really helped.
Is there a specific example, maybe in the last year or so, where something happened where you thought, you know what, if I hadn't been down here, hadn't had this much communication, maybe we wouldn't have been able to do this?
I don't know that it's something that we did. I think it's more of the conversations that you get in with players, where if a player has an issue, I mean, a big thing for us, and Walt and I talk about this since he took the job, is just limiting the distractions around our players. Let's focus on winning. And when a player has an issue, they tend to not want to bring it up. They tend to not want to say anything because they don't want to look bad that they brought up an issue. But for me, I welcome it. Let's go. What do you got? Do you have an issue? I want it out there. I want all our players to feel like they can communicate whatever might be an issue or distraction for our ball club, to put themselves in a position of just really being able to focus on winning. That daily interaction of them being able to do that and somebody being there that they feel like that's the person I talk to in this situation, I think that's what's most helpful.
Okay. Let's talk about analytics. Let's start with you, Bobby. The Giants have been for years widely perceived as a team that's a more old-school scouting organization. And yet, I know that not to be true. It's maybe not widely known, but how deep are you guys into analytics, and how has it evolved over, say, the past 10 years?
Well, I think that when some of the analytics were, even in the Moneyball story, I think that every ball club at some level was going through a transition of implementing analytics into their decision making, and Brian has always looked at it as another tool, another piece of information to bring to the table. So at the same time, in and around exactly the same time where the story of Moneyball comes, we're doing the same thing, but we're doing it in a different way, because Brian, in his approach, was to bring it into the room and make it a piece of information. And we're in the draft room. It's something that's talked about. It's something that's brought forward, but it never became a dominant influencer of decisions. It became a part of the decision-making process, really first at the amateur level and then obviously at the big league level. For us, we try to compile all of our information into as tight a summary as we can. Really, we call it really the GM summary, if you will, just to bring to Brian the metrics, the metrics that we feel are the priority, some that he prefers or that we feel that tells the best story. We also compile into that more traditional numbers, as well as scouting reports and comments and feedback that we have received that is current and some historical, and really take all of that together. With the benefit of the latest technology and HitFX and PitchFX, and try to bring a snapshot to Brian about a given player or a given opportunity we have in acquiring a player, and it's never one piece. There's invariably something that may make a stronger statement, that may stand out, and that may become a bigger part of that decision, but the next player may have something else, maybe more on the analytical side, maybe more on the scouting side that stands out, but we really need all the information, and we don't want to make any decision without all of it. It's really handcuffing yourself not to.
How many analysts do you guys employ full-time?
Well, I think every one of us that are in the baseball department play a role in analytics. But in terms of a combination of our staff that does it full time, it's hard to say. I mean, there's really a department that influences these decisions, but there's five people that I think play a greater role in this. Than myself, a greater role than Brian and I do, that really support and bring information forward. But everybody that's in our department has some role in bringing forth some of this analysis to help us make the best decisions possible. I think Bill said it well. It takes all of us together to make decisions, and there's not just a general manager relying on his own tools. He's using his team to bring forth the best information possible to make decisions. But five is a conservative estimate, given that all of us in some way provide analytics feedback and information in our decisions.
Jack, you've been a GM. This is your sixth year. How has your use of analytics evolved during that time, and where are you guys now in terms of the size of your department?
Yeah, I mean, it's increased quite a bit, in fact. I'm very happy with the group we have. We have eight guys that do various things for us. We have two that work on the amateur side with our scouting director. We have two that work with our pro scouting director. We have the other group that work with the major league group. They all do a combination of things that help the Major League Ball Club. And then we have two that work on the advanced side. And everybody is somewhat combined. But I like to use it, and I don't know how any general manager in this day and age anywhere cannot count on that information. You know, I was telling Kenny beforehand, you know, I've got a really good group of scouts out there with great levels of experience. You talk about a guy like Ted Simmons, a guy like Pete Vukovic, I like Woody Woodward, former general manager, Joe McElvain, former general manager. I've got scouting directors under me that work in my department. But then you have the analytical group that brings it all together. And I know that any single time, even this year, immensely, we talked about every one of these players out there, I'll challenge the group of guys that work on our analytical side. I will hear from the scouts. They'll give me their information. I'll hear from the former general managers in my department that give me their information. But how you do not tie the analytics into this is impossible. I mean, we're living, this is you know, 2014. You have to have it. So from my perspective, my background is traditional. You know, I've been out in the field for years as a farm director, as a scouting director, and many years as a scout. As a general manager now, your job is to make decisions based on a gamut of information and the best information that you can get. So how I view this is this group of people that, and I was telling Kenny where they went to college, really bright guys went to Harvard, guys went to Claremore McKenna, I mean, some tremendous schools, University of Chicago, Kansas State, Illinois. It's a great group of guys. You tie it together, you make your decisions based on all the information, and your level of experience helps you do that.
Bill, same question with regard to the Rockies. How have you guys progressed over the years in terms of analytics, and where are you now in terms of how you do it, number of people you have involved?
We have four main guys involved, and they're probably already analyzed how many words a sentence I've used. But they're right over here. I want them to stand up, because if anybody... Go ahead, Mr. Zach Rosenthal, who heads our stuff there. Stand up. Kent McKendry. Matt Obernauer. Trevor Patch. I want everybody to see him, because if you're looking for a job, those are the guys that you go to see. You're welcome. We've been pretty deep in all this analytics for quite some time. I got to credit that group, because anything and everything that we either want to look at or try to study, and we feel like we need to, for one, because of our venue, but at the same time, just trying to evaluate and look at everything. It's really come to the point. You know, I laugh in some of this stuff, because I can remember in 1993 sitting with Larry Corrigan, who was a West Coast supervisor of the Twins. I'm an area scout with the New York Yankees out in California. We're sitting in Visalia watching a California League game doing runs created by hand. And I hear all this scouts and stat stuff and whatever else. I can remember sitting there, me and Joe Kerrigan in 1995, playing a game where we were looking at somebody, a pitcher's stats, and trying to figure out if he had a two-seamer or just a four-seamer, and what combination of that. Is it a curveball? Is it a slider? And then trying to match that up with the scouting report. So these things have been going on for an awful long time. I just don't think it's been out there for people really to understand, for either scouts or people in the field. But at the same time, it's really gotten to a point, I'd say, with our group and as an industry, as I see it kind of unfold, and as you watch it, is that statistical research has really gotten to the point where, you know, there's four basic components of a I'd say the construct of making a decision, and Jack hit on all four of them, whether it's contract or acquisition cost, whether it's a medical information, whether it's your scouting reports, or whether it's statistical research. And those, now there's four ways to basically kill a player, as I like to say, because you know, the medical guys, they'll leave a trail of bodies all around the country when you're trying to find out who you can sign. In the same way with contracts or whatever else. So it's really gotten to the point now where it's part of the backbone of the construct to make a decision.
Now, given all that, the international market has never been more fertile. The Cuban market, Asian market, and of course the rest of Latin America as well. When you go into a situation where we're talking about an international player that is somewhat established, Jose Abreu, you guys bid on him, Tanaka, we know about him. How do analytics play a role there, and how do you guys figure out the translation from his league in his native country to the major leagues? Jack, let's start.
Well, if it's a pro player, then I think you're doing comparisons the very best you can. You know, Jesse Smith is here with us. Billy, you introduced your guys. I got my guys. Jesse, stand up. You know, Jesse does a lot of our analytics with pitching. He does a tremendous job. Caleb Pfeiffer, stand up, Caleb, as well in our department. And Wes Battle, stand up, Wes. So I'll go a lot of these guys and I'll say, give me what you got on Tanaka. And they'll run their comparisons on how he compares to previous pitchers that came out of Japan, how those pitchers did in the United States. And, you know, it's, and then you have your people that have been over there to watch him and make their comparisons that have seen him eye to eye. Obviously, on amateur players internationally, I don't see how you can tie in a lot of analytics into them. You can't. You know, having been an international director before, you know, you're going in to see kids that are 16 years of age. You have no clue except their raw skills. Many of them never, and one of the most understood things about certainly the international amateur market, because a lot of those kids don't even play in leagues. You know, you go to workouts. But I think when you're looking at acquiring a professional player, even a United States player that's gone over there, you know, you have to make the best comparisons you can on how they performed there compared to the body of work there and what they had when they were in the States. You know, it just gets down to an educated assumption on how you project internally, which we have our own system, that how they will perform when you bring them here.
Bill, let's talk about Abreu. What did you guys know? What did you see? And why did you think he was a guy that could fit well?
Well, we thought tremendous bat potential. Middle of the lineup run producer. You know, if you look at those four things, you know, we didn't have issues on the medical. We didn't have issues except for those high acquisition cost for a guy with very limited experience, where you could see and kind of gauge the level of competition, you know, and that's the thing I think moving forward is, you know, with so many players coming from Cuba, what is that Cuban league like now? And how can you truly evaluate the numbers and statistics that you've seen in the past, you know, relative to what it is now? What is that league like now? With all the players coming over here. And I think that's an interesting idea to look at as you look at the numbers in Cuba. So there's definitely some risk there. There was definitely some unknown. But in all the issues that we looked at, and we felt like we could afford them at the number, we were, you know, pretty high up there compared to where the White Sox signed them. So we were just a little bit shy of them. But it just got to the point where, you know, we couldn't go any further with where our payroll was. But you know, the analytics sure did play into it with a, you know, higher walk, lower strikeout type of guy with power and a right-handed bat, which is very difficult to find in this game right now for whatever reason. We felt like that was a good one to go on.
Bobby, with you guys right now, the Giants, internationally, how heavy are you involved both on the amateur side and the pro side?
Well, we've heavily scouted everybody that has been available, including Tanaka. I don't know how many. I don't know if it was a dozen scouts that we sent to Japan this year, but we're covering it and preparing ourselves for the options that are going to be available. I think the tough thing about the Cuban market is that you never know when they're going to become available. So you have to keep your powder dry, so to speak, to make sure that you're available to get involved in the market. But the fact is that there's markets emerging that are very exciting for baseball, and talent acquisition doesn't necessarily just come through the traditional means of the amateur draft and Latin America and the free agent market. There's other ways to acquire talent, and trying to take advantage of that is really being prepared and making sure that you are ready for the opportunity. And then what triggers it ultimately may be the market of that player or the need that that player can address on your club, but a big part of it for all clubs is to be prepared and to know who's out there and who's available. And I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce a couple of our giants here today. Adam Needing and Paul Bien, if you'd stand, welcome. At least those are the two that I know are here. So thank you guys for representing the Giants as a part of our staff. Thank you, Ken.
All right, we got it. Now, we're going to open it up a little bit to questions. I've asked enough. So if anybody has a question, just raise their hand. Let's start right here.
Good morning. I'm from South Korea, and then I have some question. All panels, and will you sign with an Asian player within next 5 years? And then, do you think the World Baseball Classics and then 2008 Beijing Olympic Games changed your perception over Asian player or some other international players?
I personally love the World Classic for the opportunity to see players that we've never gotten to see stateside. It's been, I think, beneficial to us. It's given us a good building block. But clearly we're able to see quality baseball in Korea and Japan. Via many means, including the scouting and the accessibility that we have to the statistics, and even American players that have gone over there and come back that have given us great reports on their experience, including our own Ryan Vogelsong. We had a former player, Ryan Sadowski, both who just had great experiences playing overseas. And I think there's a lot to be learned about the Asian player and the style of baseball over there and how it translates to the big leagues, but I do think we're benefiting from seeing them stateside as well as getting a chance to scout them overseas.
Okay. Next question. Over here.
Hi, good morning. I would like to know more about your draft preparation. So our analytics is involved not to pick specific players, but to know when to pick him. So do you have anything analytics-wise that help you know if that player has a high probability to be available in the fourth round versus the fifth round, and so on?
The question's about the draft, Jack. Go ahead.
I didn't hear the question. I heard it, but I didn't understand.
I think basically the question was, and correct me if I'm wrong, he wants to know, how do you determine when a player is a first-round guy, what makes you think that, versus a 10th-round guy, 5th-round guy, et cetera.
Interesting. I would say years ago as a scouting director, we all have these great systems that we put together. The guy's a 70 or a guy's a 68 or a guy's a 65. Technically, you could say he's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. What becomes available is when you sit in a room, you want to take the best player. That's just the way it is. No matter how you line your board up, you can say these guys are going to be excellence, or these guys are going to be all-stars, or this guy's going to be an everyday player. The bottom line is when you're picking, you want to take the best player. That's it. Case closed. So how you line them up, though, is so important. And like I said, if you had to first pick in a draft, as an example, the decision is, do you take the best player? Sure, of course, you hope you do. But you could also take the best pitcher, the best position player, the best catcher, the best shortstop. And you can go through the draft. I go back to I hope I'm answering this correctly, but you could go back to the year that Tulowitzki was taken by Colorado. We had taken Ryan Braun in Pittsburgh. Ricky Romero went 6. You had Andrew McCutchen was in that draft. Upton was in that draft. Who else was in that draft? Was second pick by Kansas City. Their left fielder. The left. Gordon, yeah. Gordon was in a draft. You had Cameron. So you look at all this group of players, and you might, if you draft for need, I think that's a mistake. Because I've been criticized in the past taking too many first basemen. Well, guess what? One of them turned out to be really good. Another one turned out to be moved to the outfield in Corey Hart's scenario, and another one got a cup of coffee. So the point is, take the best players, no matter what. Take the best players. Fill your organization. You're too far away from the big leagues to be so specific, in my opinion.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen, and thank you. My question would be, as the trade deadline approaches in late July, is the hesitancy to trade within the division that's reported, is that real?
I'm going to take this one. You know, we have never really traded with the Giants. One, we don't like them personally more than anything. But we're kind of getting over that. So Bobby and I talked about Marco Scudero, who we knew was a very good player. As our season was kind of playing out and things weren't going well for us, Marco was a name that we had talked about with some clubs. Very good player. We really liked him, but we knew for how our season going, we'd probably be better off getting a younger player. The Giants ended up winning World Series with that guy. As a big part of it, I don't know how much of that ring I get as far as that goes. No, but Bobby and I talked on the phone, and certainly Brian and Dan were involved as far as what was going on there. But there was a hesitancy. There was a level of, you know, do we really want to help the Giants? We know we're giving them a good player. At the same time, for what was out there for him, maybe hard for people to believe, they had the best deal. And with that in mind, and there wasn't a lot of deals for him, which is hard to believe, but that was the best one. And in the end, we said, you know, even though we might be helping the Giants, it's probably the best thing for our ball club.
Hey, just a follow-up to that. Quick answers, all three of you. How hairy is it, the trade deadline at last hour, and how difficult is it to think with all that's going on in front of you?
There's a buildup. I mean, I think there's always that tendency to, do you make the deal, you don't make the deal. Personally, I don't care who I trade with, you know, if it's in our division or not. If I get the return you're looking for, it can get hairy. This year is a good example. We didn't make any moves and got criticized for it. We had probably 4 or 5 guys we could have moved. But, man, it started that last, I'd say the last 15, 20 minutes, we were getting calls left and right. You're going to move Morse. You're going to move Morales. You're going to move Oliver Perez, whoever it was. So it can get, you know, it can get cramped too, because now all of a sudden someone pops in a picture that you really hadn't thought about, and it can get confusing. But you know, you just keep it under control, and if you're going to make a move, you'll make a move for the best player.
Bill,
I think what we're starting to see is things are unfolding quicker. You know, we really don't wait until. I mean, I can remember one time we were sitting in the office. We got a call. This is probably 6-7 years ago, maybe more than that, where it was 2 minutes to the deadline. And the first time we've talked about a trade, and we executed it. But at the same point, I think you're starting to see it earlier now. I think clubs are just more ready to act now than they ever were. I think, as you know, all the research and all the stuff, you really target the guys that you want with other teams, and so much work has to be done to lead up to making a decision to do it, where you can't just pick up the phone and then call your scout and you make a trade. Those days are over. So to do all that research and to have all your due diligence done and completed, it takes some time. So you know well ahead of who you want to go to.
That said, Bobby, you got a crazy final hour story?
Well, we've had 2 of the last 4 years. We've had really some last minute deals that actually didn't get executed, but that due diligence is part of the hang up, because you do need to do medical review and that sort of thing, and sometimes names don't come up until to finish a deal till the last minute. Jack and I were working on one where we, you know, really came down to that last 20 minutes, and we just couldn't get it executed. And you never know what may come up. Sometimes the ask changes in the closing minutes, and that can precipitate conversations. Sometimes when two or three deals start to really zone in on a conclusion of the trade deadline, that you really then have to prioritize. So we had one even this past off season with the White Sox where we were close to something, and it just again didn't happen. But in the end, that last hour does get to be an adventure sometimes.
All right, next question over there.
So the art of a two-team deal seems simple enough, but how do you get the ball rolling on a three-team deal?
Great question.
It's all about need. You know, I could talk to Billy, I could talk to Bobby, and they have a need for a player I have, and I will say to them, we've looked at your club right now. We just talked about this here this morning, you know, and I just don't see the match. It's kind of same thing with Bobby. I don't see the match. But they have conversations going on somewhere else. And they say, what do you really need? When you tell them what you're looking for, they say, well, it just so happens I've got a conversation going on with another ball club. And would you mind doing a three-team deal? And that's how the deal ends up. And there are some general managers who should turn that into a four- and five-year team deal before it's all over. But that's really how it works. You have to be, I think all of us have to agree that we're willing to bring in a third party in the deal to get the need I want, to get the need they want, to get the third party's need.
And it's really tough because you can't be in a position where you're trading other people's players.
Yeah.
So you can't say, if Jack says he needs this and maybe Bobby, I know if we trade that with Bobby, then we can send it to Jack. But you can't, hey, what if I can get this guy? And whatever, you start talking about other people's players is probably a big no-no, which clubs start getting into. But
you know, and there's a big trust factor there, too, because I've had this happen to me, Billy, I'm sure Bobby has had it happen, too. Well, you'll talk to a club and say, hey, you know, I want to bring a third team in the deal. An hour or 2 hours later, you'll get a call from that third club. Say, hey, I hear we're involved in this deal. Whoa. Wait a minute. No, we're not there. You know, you're trading a player that's not even your property yet, and that breaks a trust factor, I think, between all of us.
Okay.
What analytics do you rely on to assess minor league development?
What analytics do you rely on to assess minor league development?
I mean, the biggest thing is really projection, taking the minor league stats and projecting them versus comparable players that have had successful major league careers, and trying to project the comparable performance of that player in that league and as they advance through the system, what that looks like at a big league level. That's really the primary thing, is projections for us.
And the other part to that is there are no guarantees. You know, we've all sat there, we've all had them. We either injury factor, or a guy produces tremendously at the minor league level. Age is a factor, level he's playing at is a factor. Those have to be comparisons or factors. But what happens is we've all had that, and I say this forever. You know, you got guys that surprise you and guys that break your heart. And we're living it right now with some players that we've made deals with, we're really excited about and haven't been quite who we thought they were. But you go back and look at their projections comparably, all the earmarks said these guys should be very successful players. For some reason, the bottom line to a lot of this, real simple, it's the human element. You can take it all. You can do the analytics, which are phenomenal. Our scouts can see it with their eyes. In so many cases, it's what's in a guy's heart and soul that allows a guy to achieve what he should achieve.
Yes, you had mentioned the looking at the Asian markets, and I think going back to the time of the initial World Baseball Classic and back when baseball was played in the Olympics, at perhaps some surprise at the quality of baseball coming out of Korea. And does MLB looking at any other, I'll call them emerging markets, that we might be surprised at, say Australia or, I don't know, Easter Island?
I don't know about Easter Island. Maybe we have a scout there. Well, the Pacific Rim has always been, I think the presence of Major League Baseball has long been in Pacific Rim, Asia and Australia. As far as truly anything else, I think that's the whole idea of the WBC and what's going on with that. Certainly throughout Latin America and even in South America in a lot of cases. I mean, we're always expanding, and whether it's in Europe and scouts in Europe. And I mean, Major League Baseball has its tentacles everywhere. Anywhere there's baseball being played, there's some type of, maybe not with all teams, but with some teams, they're in, I'd say, in every continent, to be quite honest with you, if there's a baseball game being played.
All right, we've got time for one more question.
Jack, we heard how the Rockies have revitalized their front office in order to better align the front office with their on-field personnel. In light of your offseason, what review have you taken and what changes are you going to make?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, I don't think we're going to do what the Rockies are doing. I think that's unique for them and their personalities. You know, we've just had a change with a new president in our organization, so that's interesting as well. I think Kevin Mather is, you know, have a slightly different approach, I think, to some things. You know, but I think that we use all of our personnel. You know, I don't think that we have sold anybody short within the organization. I think that we rely on everything. I think as a general manager, you manage up, you manage down, you manage sideways. You try to bring everybody into the loop on what you're doing when you're making a decision. As Billy touched on before, there's so many people involved in a single decision that offer so many different areas of expertise, and you just try to bring it all together. So I think we're going to stay the course for now, and if, you know, should we become revolutionary in the future, I'll let you know.
All right, I want to thank everybody on the panel, Jack Cirencic, Bill Guyvett, Bobby Evans.